made late at night as a few of us wrestled with the complexity of all that we had heard and seen. Undoubtedly, it was one of the Christians in the crowd who brought up the impossibility and the necessity of forgiveness if ever the peoples of this land were to live together in peace. The thought prompted one of our Jewish colleagues to say that he did not know what we meant by the word forgiveness. "I don't know what forgiveness is," he said. "Our community is a community of memory, not of forgiveness." The words stunned me and have continued to remind me how little I understand of another's way of seeing, believing, knowing, acting. But another way, the words continue to underline how blithely I presume that my way of seeing, believing, knowing, and acting is normative. Once back in my study, I could not help but wonder if forgiveness were a distinctively Christian concept. When asked to summarize the contribution of each religion to the whole of human history, Houston Smith, the great scholar of world religions, had only one word for Christianity: forgiveness. That said, our common scripture begins in the beginning, and with the stories of the patriarchs whose tombs in Hebron were too dangerous for us to visit. Surely forgiveness among God's people was to be found in these stories that are shared by Christians and Jews, and even some of those stories shared by Muslims. So I went to the Bible in search of such a story. Joseph and his brothers being too obvious an example, I page back to the story that I have always thought of as a story of forgiveness, the end of the story of Esau and Jacob, their meeting. You will remember that Esau was the oldest twin. I will rehearse a bit too, but a little different part of the story. Esau was the oldest twin, the firstborn destined to receive Isaac's blessing and really the big part of the estate. But Mother Rachel's heart belonged to Jacob. So when the time was right, a little later in the story than Diane was telling the children, Rachel plotted with her youngest to trick blind old Isaac into giving his blessing to Jacob, which was a pretty big deal. And when Esau found out, this prompted him to cry a cry that has echoed down the bloody history of world religions. "Have you only one blessing, Father? Bless me also, Father." Now, Esau hated Jacob and vowed to kill him. Jacob ran for his life and lived in fear of what might happen if one day their paths should cross. Well, we pick up the story this morning decades later. It is the morning after Jacob has wrestled with a stranger, perhaps God, into the night for a blessing. Of that encounter, the now blessed, renamed, and limping Israel declares, "I have seen God's face to face, and yet my life is preserved." It is also the morning of Jacob's carefully orchestrated encounter with his brother Esau. The scene anticipates, I think, the return of the prodigal, save that what Jacob sees down the road is his brother with 400 men. Going ahead of his wives, the children, his servants, Jacob bows 7 times on the way to the place where the brother is standing watching. When the man imagines the scene in slow motion, in silence. But suddenly, as I read the text, Esau comes running to meet his brother, like the father running to meet the prodigal, embracing him, falling on his neck, and kissing him. The brothers both. These two men estranged for a lifetime, these two tribes, I thought, letting bygones be bygones. Here, a story we share, here is forgiveness, mercy, grace. Esau meets Jacob's family. Jacob offers presents to Esau that he might find favor. Esau declines graciously, but Jacob insists, saying, "To see your face, it's like seeing the face of God, since you have received me with such favor." Seeing God's image in the dreaded other. Incredible. Incredible, I think. Finally, Esau invites Jacob to walk with him. "Let us journey together, and I will go alongside you." Jacob is all excuses, promising to meet Esau later in Seir, but he never does, leaving me to suspect that a community of memory has heard a very different word in the 33rd of Genesis than my own community of forgiveness. I turn to the rabbis and to Midrashim for help. If I had any doubts before, I am now certain that my way of seeing, believing, knowing, and acting is anything but normative. The midrash I find is a midrash, a story told on the story, a midrash on the phrase, "and kissed him." Apparently, the rule of interpretation is this, and I'll find out how is wrong afterwards because Matt knows Hebrew and I do not, but apparently the rule with the rabbis of interpretation is this. If in Hebrew, and Hebrew has these letters and I think vowels are missing and then there are dots all over everything, if in Hebrew the plain words exceed the dots, interpret the plain wording. If the dots exceed the plain wording, interpret the dotted letters. In the case of "and kissed him," plain wording and dots are equal. Says Rabbi Simeon ben Eliezer, Esau kissed Jacob with all his heart. Rabbi Janai replies, if that were so, there would be no reason for the dots. Dots mean that Esau wanted to bite Jacob, that the Jacob's neck was turned to marble, and Esau's teeth were blunted and bruised. Hence the words, "and they wept," reflect that Jacob wept because of his neck, and Esau wept because of his teeth. According to another source, the dots are a graphic imprint of the bite itself. But I keep reading and learn this. Learn that throughout Jewish history, Esau has represented the hostile mother. Even when Esau seems to act with nobility and forgiveness, the tradition does not buy it. So the struggle between Jacob and Esau took on in Jewish tradition the veneer of much more than just sibling rivalry. The sages saw in the brothers a typological struggle not only between two political entities and ideologies, big Wisconsin, but even more so, a conflict between two competing civilizations. Strap on your seatbelt. For them, Jacob represented the people of Israel and Judea. share together this world and the world to come. Realizing that it was Jacob, the Jew, who merited the world to come, and Esau, the Christian, wanted to latch on so that he too would partake of it. The Midrash reflects a reality where the sages felt that Rome, Christians, wanted to cling to the religious legacy of the Jews as the best route to redemption. This must have incensed the Jews, who had suffered so grievously at the hands of the Romans, who had stolen their sovereignty and robbed them of the ability to practice their religion free of Roman involvement. Consequently, any attempts by Esau to claim the mantle of the Jewish tradition could only be met with scorn, since Roman oppression was indicative that it lacked the sincerity of true religion. It has a funny ring to it, except inside out, doesn't it? For us. Ultimately, the article concludes, God's truth will triumph. Two narratives, two ways of seeing, believing, knowing, acting. One land, one God. What to do? Politics, writes Donald Shriver in An Ethic for Enemies, Forgiveness in Politics. Politics is how humans get along with each other in spite of their conflicts. One of our most necessary, most fragile human achievements. Are we listening for ourselves today in this nation? From a million years back, we have been a fractious species. Fighting comes easily to us. But cooperation had to come too, or else we might not have survived our combativeness. According to Shriver, cherishing hope for revenge is one way sufferers of atrocity cope with their memories. But there is another way. The facing of still rankling past evils with first regard for the truth of what really happened. Then, second, with resistance to the lures of revenge by means of forbearance, which opens the door toward a future that will not repeat old crimes. So remembering truthfully, forbearing, rather than turning toward revenge. Third, empathy, with no excused people for all the agents and sufferers of the evil. And finally, with real intent on the part of the sufferers to resume life alongside the evildoers or their political successor. This, says Shriver, is the moral courage of forgiveness. I think of South Africa and Desmond Tutu. I pray another like him will emerge this day in Northern Africa. Our teachers, continued Shriver, our teachers have to be the sufferers themselves, the victims of colossal evil, or those with the most right to represent them. Elie Wiesel has always been one of my teachers. Jews, he writes, must never and will never forget the Jewish tragedy that marked the last century and will haunt all centuries to come. To forget would be a sin. To remember is essential. It is a worthy endeavor, a noble cause for which many of us have fought relentlessly. We are a community of memory, not forgiveness, said my friend. But, asks Wiesel, does it justify intolerance? Hatred, he concludes, hatred does not serve memory. There is another way to read this story, said a rabbi to his congregation. Perhaps Jacob had to overcome his own anger and fear by recognizing the divine spark in the brother. His brother was not all wickedness, but a person like himself, capable of teshuvah, repentance, and forgiveness. For Jacob to be able to brave conciliation, he first had to make clear in his own heart and his own mind that his brother was not pure evil, but rather a human being, like himself, to see in his face God's face. Hate does not serve memory. I think I know this more these days personally than I do politically. Therefore, my first instinct in the hotel bar overlooking the old city of Jerusalem that night was to quit the political for the personal. "Think of your marriage," I said to my friend. "No marriage can survive without forgiveness." Still, my new friend looked at me blankly. Since our conversation, I've been trying to imagine my own life without the attempt, however flawed, to forgive, and without the humbling experience, however undeserved, of being forgiven. Absent forgiveness, I know that my memories would be haunted by unresolved partings. My mind, filled with the sort of conversation you keep having with yourself, you know these conversations to convince yourself that you were right and the other was wrong. If when I asked a fellow Presbyterian on the trip if there were someone he could not imagine forgiving, he told me of his ongoing anger that will not let him forgive a wrong done to his son. I think now of parents whose child has been bullied or abused or violated by someone who had been trusted with that child's one precious life. For a moment, forgiveness is unimaginable. And in that moment, I multiply the children whose faces I know by hundreds of thousands of children on both sides and from every tribe over thousands of years. Forgiveness. I stare blankly. My job is not to forgive, but to give meaning, writes Sherry Mendel, the mother of whom I spoke last week, the mother of Kobe, who was stoned to death at the age of 13 outside their settlement in Tacoa. My job is to give meaning. My job is to remember. I will remember that the rock of Jacob, my son Kobe's name, is another name for God, and that Jacob put rocks together as a pillow to dream on. The rock can be an instrument of rage or a symbol of God's holiness. Even the name of rock can be the name of God. Anything can be exploited for evil or sanctified for holiness. Kobe's death breaks my heart of stone, so that my tears are an endless spring that soaks the ground and allows the seeds planted there to break through the darkness. My friends, in the face of immense human brokenness on every side, when the personal becomes political, we who call ourselves Christians confess our faith in the God whose Son has borne the vengeful anger and the broken hearts of God's warring children all the way to the cross. The silence between the confession and the Kyrie of a Sunday morning can never be long enough for the righteously wronged to let go of the anger that separates in favor of the grace that alone has the power to make all things has wronged us. By his grace alone, I pray that this community may become, now and again, for the sake of the world God so loved, a community of memory and forgiveness. A community that, after remembering past sins rightly and the pain they have caused, is enabled to ask for forgiveness and to forgive, to console and to be consoled, so that we might not, so the world might not, be overwhelmed by excessive sorrow.